For over a century, the medium of radio has created a unique intimacy between broadcasters and their audience like no other art form. Echoing and celebrating the changing face of popular culture, radio stars occupy a certain space in the story of entertainment. In this series, some of Britain's most recognisable voices reflect on their own relationship with the original content creator. So, join us as we celebrate the power and magic of radio exclusively on Beyond the Title.
One of the most popular TV stars of the 90s, thanks to her contribution to the seminal Channel 4 entertainment show, The Big Breakfast, writer and broadcaster Gary Roslin was always destined to make some waves on the small screen. Yet following guest spots on Radio 2, in 2010 she replaced Joanne Good for the BBC London Breakfast Show, originally alongside Paul Ross, before fronting her own Sunday afternoon show. In 2018, she launched her very own radio comedy panel show, Gabby's Talking Pictures, bringing to life moments from classic cinema with some of Britain's leading impressionists. This year, Roslin has stood in for presenter Kate Lawler on Drive Time Virgin Radio, and has since took the hot seat on Radio 2's Steve Wright Sunday Love Songs, which is the perfect accompaniment to her star-studded That Gabby Roslin podcast, available from all the standard podcast providers. As part of Beyond the Title's radio season, I caught up with one of my broadcasting heroines to celebrate her fast achievements in the spoken word. Ladies and gentlemen, let's talk radio with Gabby Roslin. So firstly, Gabby, welcome back to Beyond the Title for this very special podcast as part of our radio season. Last time you were on the podcast, you said that it was your dream to be a TV presenter. So by way of an introduction, what was your relationship with radio growing up, and did you have any radio heroes?
My father was in radio. So my father was a continuity announcer on BBC television on BBC Two, and he also was on radio. So he was one of the people who started up LBC before it is as it is now. He worked on BBC Radio 4 as a newsreader. He helped launch 5 Live, which was then BBC Radio 5. So very much radio was a big part of my growing up. So I got to see television and radio. Television was without a doubt my first love. And I sort of fell into radio 15 years ago, and I love it.
I want to be a radio. Is that what got you in?
Josh was doing a bit of research into your dad. So was that what got you into entertainment?
Yes, because I used to go to BBC TV Centre with him when I was very, very, very little. So at about the age of 3, I remember walking into the BBC Television Centre and just looking around and just going, this is where I want to be. And then we watched Blue Peter, and I thought, that's what I wanted to be doing. I wanted to do kids' telly. So when I was a child, I wanted to do kids' telly because that was Blue Peter. And then there was Saturday morning kids' telly. So I was very lucky that I ended up doing Saturday morning kids' telly. And just before the very first show, I remember being behind the scenes, backstage, whatever you want to call it. And there was, I heard in my ear, and we go live in 10, 9. And I'd been doing television for a couple of years before that anyway, on satellite telly. But this was now my dream as a child, was to do Saturday morning live telly. And then suddenly they said, you're live on Saturday morning. There was a part of me that just thought, wow, dreams do come true. They really do.
We'll, of course, get on to your association with radio in a second. But you arguably came to national prominence in 1992 on the seminal Big Breakfast. In what ways did this show echo the entertainment landscape in a way more associated with the intimacy of radio? And how would you sum up that period of the 90s?
Wow. So I'd done 3 years of Saturday morning telly, and everybody used to say to me, what would you like to do next? And I used to say, wouldn't it be great if you could do this every day of the week? There were no shows that you could do that on. So when I started, I got my first call about would I go and audition for The Big Breakfast. I just thought, what? Oh, my goodness, this sounds incredible. It was an amazing time. It's 30 years ago at the end of this month that it launched. I think it changed TV because suddenly you were seeing the crew. Suddenly we were unscripted. It was unwritten. It was ad-libbed. It was, we had flag posts. We knew what we had to hit. But it was anarchic, but in a kind way. There was no sort of nastiness or cruelty about it. It was great fun. And I think it did change the way people see television. I think sometimes television can be a bit safe these days. Thinking back to that time, I can only think back as one of complete and utter joy. Work with Chris every day was fantastic.
What do you think of the reboot of The Big Breakfast?
I haven't seen it. I absolutely haven't seen it. So it's no word of a lie. I haven't seen it yet, I'm afraid.
Maybe I'm looking at my childhood through rose-tinted spectacles, but I feel the 90s had a definitive cultural identity in a way that has been diluted in the succeeding decades. How do you think the socioeconomic structure of the period forced such an emphasis on popular culture?
No, it's very interesting. I think a lot of people say that about... I was talking to somebody in her mid-70s who was saying the same thing about the 60s. And I think there were... the 80s music-wise was very strong. The 90s, there was the whole... There was a feeling of the 90s, wasn't there? I suppose with the whole Britpop and Oasis Blur and 90s... raves and going out, and there was a different feel about the 90s. I wonder if we all do look slightly rose tinted spectacles at everything that we remember. I mean, I often say I think it's really important that there's no golden age. I think that each age is a golden age. Each age has its golden time. I do think that things have become a bit formulaic music wise. There are obviously some incredible standout acts, without a doubt, and you know, a few come to mind, and there are a few, but I think music-wise, I think television, I think, you know, film pushes the boundaries, but in a sort of safe way. I think like I said before, I think everything's a little bit safe.
Yeah.
If this is a podcast celebrating the art of radio, then we have to talk about the unofficial godfather of mainstream radio. As someone who knew the legendary Terry Wogan well, what was it about his style and tone which made the perfect formula for radio?
Terry, gosh, I worked with him for 11 years and knew him very well. He had this extraordinary sort of relaxed attitude to it all, as if he didn't care, but he cared hugely. And I think what's a really good lesson to remember is that he cared about his listener. And I think that's always the thing. I think I think it's the most important thing to remember is you care about the person who's listening, the person who's watching, the person who's reading, if it's, but whatever it is. And don't, let me turn my phone off. Not think about you. I think that's awful when a presenter, it's just me, me, me. I'm lucky because I'm an interviewer, so when I have guests, it's about the people who are listening or watching, and it's about the guest. The presenter should be the least important, but should be the mouthpiece for the people who are listening and watching.
You're, of course, no stranger to the podcast format and have presented several series of That Gabby Roslin Podcast. To what extent do you think that the podcast format is now the natural evolution for the celebrity interview? And why did you want to enter the podcast world? And what makes That Gabby Roslin Podcast unique?
I wanted to enter it because I interview people and I never feel I have long enough. People tell me things that they don't tell other people. And it's been like that all my life. It's always been like that, which is quite extraordinary. Even when I was 12 years old, I'd get on a bus and somebody would tell me that their husband was divorcing them. And I went, oh gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm fascinated by people. I think podcasts, as is radio, are very, very intimate. I think people have embraced podcasts because they can take them with them anyway. I know you can with radio now, but I think people think of radio differently. And it's... Podcasts are available for everybody of all ages, and I think that's really exciting. I don't like to ever be put into a category or a bracket or a, oh, well, it's for this person or it's for this person. Why do I think it's different? I think our show, people know they're not going to be stitched up. So for that Gabby Roslin podcast, nobody's going to be stitched up. People, it's a safe place for people to talk about things, as there's the episode that launched season three with Michael Bublé. It's the most candid open interview he's ever done in his whole career. And I'm very honoured that he chose me to talk to about those things. And I just feel I it's wonderful that people feel safe enough. But you also get a laugh. I mean, people, we do have a laugh. And I ask everybody what makes them belly laugh.
Josh listens to you whilst he's in his hot tub, as it's the perfect accompaniment.
The hot tub bit I didn't get. I got that you listened to it and that it's perfect, but I didn't get the hot tub. I didn't know you had a hot tub. That's cool, Josh. Actually, it's warm. It's a hot tub.
You feature some remarkable people in your podcast, but one episode in particular sticks in my memory. What was it about your friendship with Robbie Williams which made you confident that you could produce such an amazingly honest and open conversation with him? And what are the main challenges you face when interviewing someone you know so well?
I think, I don't know if it's a challenge interviewing somebody you know well. I think it's a gift. I suppose with Michael, it's the same with Michael, because I've interviewed Michael. The very first TV show Michael ever did in the UK was with me and Terry. Was the Terry and Gabby show. But with Rob, oh, I loved it. I mean, I can talk to Rob forever. I mean, he was 15 or 16 when we first met. And he's a good guy. And I think, you know, the press tried to paint him one way going back to the 90s, obviously. So it was a joy. It was actually, for me, there's a lot of people that I know very well that I've interviewed. And what's so lovely is for everybody else, for the listener, to know that person as I know them and to see the real side of them, which I think is wonderful. Because, you know, I obviously they, when they go out and they're promoting something, they have to promote it and they have to keep going on about something. And so we get everybody who they're not promoting things. So, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but when I interview somebody, I do try and get a different side to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do a lot of research, but I even the people that I know really well, and we're always very honest when if they're on my podcast and I've known them a long time, because I'm not going to pretend I don't, but I still do a lot of research. I look back on lots of interviews. I read lots of stuff and I sort of try and find those nuggets that you can tell that they really enjoy talking about. And like, because you want somebody to feel comfortable.
The interview format is something that you're no stranger to. And in 1996, you secured your own Channel 4 chat show. What are the main differences in the radio and television interview? Looking at those interviews as a whole, what do you think they say about 90s pop culture?
Gosh, I don't know if we had too many people who were about the pop culture then, but I remember our guests. We had Tony Bennett singing live. We had Sybil Shepherd singing live. I mean, we had extraordinary guests. But there isn't any difference. In my eyes, there's no difference. So I make television for radio and radio for television. So to me, it's the same thing. I'm very visual in everything that I do, and social media, obviously, that means you can embrace that again. I never take myself too seriously. Very happy to act the fool. And I think I try to create visuals through what we're talking about, but also I think of it very visually. So I think for me, interviewing somebody is the same, absolutely the same. It's got to be intimate. It's got to be that you care, but most importantly, that you listen. Most important thing above everything else, you've got to listen.
Yeah, and that's the secret, isn't it?
Yeah, without a doubt. If you don't listen, I remember years and years and years ago, my dad, who'd interviewed thousands of people on his shows, and I remember my dad saying, if you go into an interview and you want to interview a lion specialist, and all you've done is you've got your questions set out and you've researched lions, and then 10 minutes into the interview, they say, do you know what? I'm not interested in lions anymore. I love elephants. And you go, yeah, so tell me about lions. You haven't listened. If they said, I'm not interested in elephants, you talk about those elephants. And that's, I think that's really important. So it's just about listening.
You've recently sat in for the great Steve Wright for Sunday Love Songs on Radio 2. How do you adjust your broadcasting style in order to cater for different audiences?
He's a master. Wow. Being asked to sit in for him was a huge honour. I don't think I do change, really. I suppose time of day is important. I think because I've been doing Sunday radio for a while, I think Sunday you have to stay slightly calmer. Breakfast is probably a bit more upbeat, but I think I'm always the same. So I don't know if I actually did consciously try and change it. I'm not sure.
Just last year, you were unveiled as the replacement for Kate Lawler's maternity leave on Virgin Radio. Breakfast show and drive time slots are the most significant in radio. What sort of responsibility do you feel as a broadcaster to entice the listener in and choosing to stay with you?
I think sort of in a way, drive does echo breakfast. I was called into Virgin for 2 weeks and I was there 18 months. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but it did. And breakfast is such a part of our lives, isn't it, really? Breakfast radio, breakfast television. I mean, early mornings are a very big part of my life. So for 3 years doing Motor Mouth, that was early morning. Then 3.5 years, The Big Breakfast. Then I did BBC Daytime for years and years and years. And then I did City Hospital for years. So early, and then I did 3 years of breakfast on BBC London. And then I've been sitting, then I sat in for Lorraine for a couple of years, and then I sat in for Chris. So I've done a lot of early mornings. For me, I think early mornings are very exciting. I'm not somebody who has a problem with early mornings because I love my job and I love getting up. And I think that breakfast radio is really important. It's very powerful. Wonderful Chris, wonderful Zoe. You know, they're a link to what's going on. They make you feel good. They make you think, you know, and I think all of that is really important.
At Virgin, you were somewhat reunited with someone who I'll always associate you with. What do you admire about Chris Evans and his unique rapport with his audience? And how do you think your chemistry has endured over the years?
We still love and adore each other and respect each other. And I think respect is a really important thing. We're always going to have that connection, even though it's 30 years ago that was, like I said, and 28 years ago that, because he did it for 2.5 years, I think, and I did it for 3.5. We're always going to have that. I admire him immensely. I think his radio show is brilliant. He really cares. He's passionate. And I think you have to care about what you do. Every job I do, I give it 100%, and as does he. And I think he has brilliant people around him as well, always. But he's the master. Everybody knows that. He's wonderful. Have you ever met him, Josh?
Yeah.
Yeah,
So Josh met him in person when he was younger, back in 1996. And obviously, since doing this podcast, Josh has tried numerous times to try and get him on here to do a little interview.
No, he never does. He
doesn't do podcasts.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. He wouldn't do mine. So, yeah. But I'm sure he'd love to maybe you can go along and watch his show going out or something. I can certainly give your details to his PA, Hitton, and but he won't do. He never does interviews.
Yeah, so back in 1996, Josh was invited and sat next to him whilst he did his show. And he
you've done it. Right, okay.
Yeah. Many moons ago. Yeah, and that definitely helped lay the foundations for what Josh does now.
Oh, that's amazing. He'd love to know that. Josh, how old are you? Do you mind me asking? I'm 33 and I will always be 33. I'm never changing my age.
Yeah, Josh is older than you. He's 35.
35, I got that. Yeah. He is older than me.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, he looks it.
No, because I was trying to work out if you saw him in 96, you were really young. Wow.
But when I got
So basically, way back when, Josh and his family got contacted by a company who make dreams come true. Sorry, yeah, who make wishes come true, and that's how for disabled people in particular. So they asked Josh to give three names of people that he'd like to meet. So number one on the list was Cilla Black. Number two was Chris Evans. And number three was Matthew Kelly. He doesn't know why he picked Matthew Kelly.
I thought that's what you said. I was kidding. That was very funny. Have you met Matthew now?
No.
He's a very nice man.
He must have been like stars in her eyes. You must have shows. Anyway, we digress. Interestingly, looking at your career as a whole, you could argue that it's been in reverse as a result of your roots in live TV, which was followed by your hugely successful career in radio. How did your experience as a TV presenter help to nurture your broadcasting style on radio?
I think, as I said before, that to me, they're both the same. I think you need to paint more pictures, obviously, because people can't, you know, there's no point in saying, wow, what a lovely photograph. You know, people aren't going to know what you're talking about. So you have to say, oh, I have in front of me a photograph of, and then obviously describe it. And I think that's important. But to me, it's the same thing. So I think I said before, you know, for me, they're interchangeable.
In 2018, you launched your very own radio comedy panel show, Gabby's Talking Pictures, bringing to life moments from classic cinema with some of Britain's leading impressionists. I've been extremely lucky to watch the show live on a number of occasions, and I'm always struck by how perfectly comfortable you are with controlling proceedings. How difficult and daunting is it to be in the middle of some of the most eminent comic minds in Britain, and how easy is it to control the frequently controversial but hilarious Keith Lemon?
I've known Lee a very long time. He's lovely. So it's not difficult. You just say, stop now, shush. And sometimes does. But no, it's been amazing to do this show. It's Radio 4, then the live show, and we're getting let's say fingers crossed about what's gonna happen next. But it's just been amazing. And I think our three impressionists now, wow. Josh Berry and Josh Barry, you have to do something together. I mean, let's be honest. Yeah. Barry and Berry, Josh and Josh, something. It was crazy not to. But Josh and Luke and Jess Robinson is extraordinary. I mean, her talent is, if it was years ago, she would have had her own Saturday night show. Those sort of shows don't exist anymore, but she would have these days. She's fantastic. They all are. And obviously working with Alistair McGowan, who's one of my dearest friends, as you know, was a complete joy. In fact, I'm seeing him next week. It's been amazing to do that. And some of the guests that have been on have been absolutely incredible. But everybody, the premise is that everybody loves a film. Even if they say they're not a film lover, or they don't go to the cinema, or they're not interested in movies, or there's always one film that somebody loves. And then they realise, oh, gosh, maybe I do love film more than I thought.
And when I look at my film, but you know,
yeah, and when you're watching, you might not necessarily know the film, but you'll definitely know the impression.
Yeah, yeah.
So thinking about your own radio career, what does a radio mean to you?
Live radio is so personal. It's exciting. It is sort of skin of the teeth, hamster wheel, whatever you want to call it. But that's how I love, that's why I love it. Excuse me, let's have just a glass of water. To me, anything live, I love the idea that something could go wrong. When I was doing the lottery, I remember we had, I can't remember who it was. Oh, anyway, but we were live on air and in rehearsals in the afternoon, we were saying, the guest said, oh, what happens if the machine breaks or something goes wrong? Mm-hmm. We say, well, it hasn't, but if it does, we just roll on in and we talk. And then that happened that night. The machine broke and we just carried on. And everybody in my ear, they're all going, oh, we'll have to go and cut to this and bring that. And I just carried on interviewing the guest. Anastasia, that was it. I carried on interviewing the guest. And at the very end, everyone went, you were so relaxed. I went, I loved it. Give me something to go wrong on live television or radio. Oh, and I'm in my element.
Didn't that happen another time with Bob Monkhouse, where he ended up doing a 10-minute stand-up routine? but then they cut the programme short and then come back later.
I think that did happen. It happened to me another time when I was doing the Millennium broadcast. So I was going to be on television. Well, I was on television for 28 and a half hours straight through. And after the first 15 minutes, and we were going to be linking around the world, and I was going to have, there were different men who were going to be sitting in with me over the time. And it was Michael Parkinson at the very beginning. There were so many people, Michael Palin, Hugh Edwards, Jamie Theakston, all sorts of people. But at the very beginning, it was Michael Parkinson. And within 15 minutes of the show starting, in my ear, all the cameras have gone down around the world. Everything's gone wrong. Just ad lib. And in my head, I thought, ad lib for 28 and a half hours. Yes! It took about 10 minutes and I loved it. So, yeah. Give me something going wrong on radio or telly and I'm happy.
Yeah, just remember it very well. And okay, so just to finish off, why is radio important to popular culture?
I think because it's so immediate, it's personal, it's there, it's with you, it's in your ear, which, you know, you wherever you go these days, you can take radio with you, and radio is a I think for some people, it's a comfort blanket. For some people, it's knowledge. For some people, it's entertainment, but it can be all of those things. And I love, for me, doing chat and music, because I love music as well. And, you know, it's the spine of everything that's going on. There's music playing throughout. I've always loved music. So for me, it's there and it can do any of the things that you need it to do. And how wonderful is that? And television can do the same with all the channels we have. I mean, I love television as well.